Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Mike Malott, Simon Schuster, and Jack Spencer. A little later, Pete Kumenich from the Insurance Alliance of Michigan. They changed their name this year, Jack, and I still got to get used to it. Insurance Alliance of Michigan will be talking to us about no-fault insurance and some suggested reforms that could be made to address our high insurance rates in this state. But first of all, Simon, we're going to have a rally, or there is a rally at the Capitol today as part of this initiative to legalize marijuana in the state. And it looks like this time they're pretty serious.
Yeah, I mean, there's significant momentum, at least organizationally, behind this effort. I mean, this is a broad coalition of organizations, including Michigan Normal, the Marijuana Policy Project, the ACLU of Michigan, and even the Marijuana Law Section of the State Bar of Michigan are participating in this effort. So this is definitely what we've seen in terms of a high watermark, in terms of a pooling of resources behind a legalization effort in the state.
And Jack, we remember back in 2008, it was, right, when the Marijuana Policy Project out of D.C. got involved in legalizing marijuana for medical purposes. They were successful.
They were successful through a ballot proposal, yes. They got it on there, the campaign that very much brought to light the fact that there are some very legitimate uses medical-wise for marijuana, that it was helpful for all kinds of different things. Anyone knows there were problems afterward in trying to implement how the ballot proposal was actually worded, and that led to the legislature having to deal with, or trying to deal with to this day, with some of the implications of that. But yes, as far as a ballot proposal is concerned, I don't know if anybody would want to bet a lot of money against a ballot proposal failing.
Well, and let's talk about a ballot proposal here, because what they're talking about here is regulating marijuana like alcohol, Simon, and that's a little different than what we have currently that is going to be taking shape here in the next several months with the medical marijuana distribution, which is turning into a five-tier system, really, which is a lot more stringent than regulating like alcohol.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really the question is that, I mean, a lot of things are undetermined right now in terms of what the structure of the market for medical marijuana in Michigan is going to look like after this law is implemented. There's not really a lot of answers that people who want to get in on this business have right now in terms of how big can one operation or one entity be. And so I think one of the big tensions that we're going to see moving forward is not whether marijuana is legalized, but rather how it's going to be legalized and who the players will be. Because right now there's very much a grassroots economy that's been built around medical marijuana in Michigan. And they're going to want to they have a vested interest in ensuring it stays that way, rather than having some of the corporate people who have become very large in states like Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, you know, move in. They're going to be very wary of this. And I think that you'll see some organization efforts from them down the line looking to push back against the idea of, for example, with this coalition, the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana, like alcohol, they want to have a designation for a marijuana micro business where the people directly grow and sell it, but then they're not able to wholesale to other suppliers, nor are they able to sell products from other establishments.
Now, wouldn't this be interesting if the legislature doesn't do anything about this? And let's say this passes. We could have overlapping regulations, whether it's being sold for medical purposes or whether it's being sold for recreational. And wouldn't this be interesting that the regulations for medical marijuana would be more stringent than recreational marijuana? Why even bother go through the medical marijuana chain if you can get it easier otherwise, Mike?
If it's legalized for recreational use, I think you'll see an awful lot of people throw away their cards.
Yeah, so, why go through the cards? It doesn't make any difference.
It doesn't
anymore.
Make any sense.
And so that brings up the next question then. If these guys are successful, and now that we've actually got a coalition and one train moving in the same direction as opposed to 2 years ago when you had like three different initiatives going at the same time, if they're successful, the legislature may be put in a position to have to legalize marijuana on their own to prevent what could be a nightmare logistically.
When you look at the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act at first blush, you know, it seemed like a very straightforward statute. But as we can see, as it's played out and been implemented, it's rife with loopholes and ambiguities that have caused a ton of issues for our court and legal systems. And so I think it's going to be a question of whether the legislature wants to get out ahead of this, create a regulatory framework in its own image, or deal with the hand that it's been dealt via the voters.
I think this puts the legislature in a very awkward position. You're talking about a whole lot of Republicans who would be forced to go back to their districts and explain to their conservative constituents why they voted to legalize recreational marijuana. And there are not a lot of Republicans in either the House or the Senate who are eager to do that.
Well, I can't imagine, Jack.
I don't think there's any way the legislature passes
legalization. But this could create a mess, Jack.
Yeah, they'll deal with the mess afterward. I mean, I could make the same argument if you want to see the comparison to this, see what happens when they try to pass things involving casinos and gambling. We've got the second largest number of casinos anywhere outside of Nevada, and yet you still can't get things passed because of the voters on all kinds of things involving gambling, gaming, and so on. And I would argue that this is going to be a similar situation. It's simply the path of least resistance would be to let the voters put it on, and if they mess things up, let's fix it afterward for the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, but in order to fix something over the next 3 or 4 years, you would need 3/4 support to actually make the changes necessary. And that would probably entail watering down this medical marijuana structure that was created after 8 years of pretty intense debate. It took them 8 years to fix the medical marijuana statute. How long would it take them to fix legalized marijuana? And in the meantime, what would happen is you could buy marijuana just like you were going to buy a fifth of JD.
I can make the same kind of illogical arguments about how we go about dealing with gaming and how we have been for the last 20 years, and it doesn't matter. What the fact of the actual political situation and how voters react has trumped everything else. And I think it's going to be the same thing in terms of legalizing marijuana. When it's, hey, they passed it, the voters passed it, now you can go ahead and do things to make it run more smoothly, et cetera, et cetera. But I just think politically, it's just too charged.
But from a libertarian standpoint, though, you could make the argument that it should be legalized, I suppose. I mean, if you want to go that far right on the political scale.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that may, I agree, Jack, and one of the things that may allow Republicans to keep their hands clean of the whole issue is the fact that this provision from the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana like alcohol allows for local control. It would allow local municipalities to say, we don't want any medical marijuana businesses. And that's in contrast to systems like Colorado, where they, on an individual municipal level, they're allowed to determine whether or not they want recreational outlets, but medical dispensaries are allowed anywhere in the state, and they have no say.
So we could have recreational marijuana in some cities, but in other areas you couldn't just light up if you wanted to. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that use would probably be allowed statewide. It would be the actual establishment of the businesses that would be prohibited if the locals choose.
Still, I think that this could be a something the legislature is going to want to keep on their radar. I mean, I think back to minimum wage, Jack, where the legislature preempted a ballot proposal on minimum wage and then decided to raise the minimum wage under their rules as opposed to somebody else's rules. And I just wonder if they're going to go ahead and just expand marijuana legally under their existing rules as they created them under the medical marijuana statute, as opposed to doing some new loose framework that is being set up here. Because, hey, look, 2018 could be a real bad year for Republicans. And if there's ever a year that this thing could pass, it could be 2018.
Well, I think that they would be somewhat fearful of it getting on the ballot, although I'm still not so sure that it would necessarily help Democrats if this was on the ballot at the same time or not, because I'm not so sure it is necessarily a Republican or Democratic issue. I think there's an awful lot of people who favor legalizing recreational use of marijuana who are all over the map in terms of their politics. But the problem is compared to minimum wage. Minimum wage was a situation where basically they deferred to the business community to say, what do you want us to do? And the business community basically came back and said, we are so concerned about aspects of this, particularly involving tipping places across the country in the hospitality industry. They basically said, even if it's less than a 50% chance of this thing passing, that's still too big a risk. Mm-hmm. And so they went ahead and they passed the minimum wage. I don't think it has the same stigma. But when you have to picture the candidate who is worried about a primary opponent, and the primary opponent isn't going to get into all the minutia on this or that and all the reality of how it plays out, it's just going to be he or she voted to legalize marijuana.
And that's also what I think places, you know, where these initiatives are happening right now. It's such an interesting juncture because you see a medical marijuana industry that is still like kind of amorphous and trying to regulate itself. And so there is no business community to turn to. All the dispensary owners throughout the state, under the technical auspices of the law, cannot do business. And so they don't exactly have an association that represents them professionally because it would just run afoul of some of these issues. If a petition language is certified before the licenses go out for the medical marijuana industry, I think that it's going to create a really interesting almost intersection of factors. And I can't really predict what's going to happen.
The other game I think you would see if they were going to try to pass it is you're going to have somebody come up, and you know how that's going to work politically. Somebody is going to say, this isn't about even marijuana. This is about a bunch of people trying to make a buck off it and trying to create the system where they can cash in on it. I mean, politically, this is why I think this is the kind of thing where the legislature will end up deferring to what the voters do.
That's a good point, Jack. You could have a situation where the most strident supporter of legalizing marijuana would object to what happens in the legislature because they'd rather see the ballot proposal.
Yeah, and I just, you know, the idea that this is going to create a mess and a muck and that it makes absolutely no sense to do it this way, I've never seen that necessarily have anything to do with what the legislature does.
And you've got more experience than anyone in the room, so I'll defer to you on that. Okay, with that, let's move on to our interview.
I was gonna go to court before I got high. I was gonna pay my child support, but then I got high.
No, you wasn't.
They took my whole paycheck, and I know why.
Joining us now for the podcast is the head of the Insurance Alliance of Michigan, Pete Kubinich. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
I'm glad to be here, Kyle. Thank you.
All right, so for our listeners' benefit, we used to have two lobbying entities in this state that lobbied for insurance purposes. Now we have one, and it is called the Insurance Alliance of Michigan.
That's correct. About, early April of this year, we were able to basically agree to what they call a joinder. So we put the two organizations together. It was the former Insurance Institute of Michigan, which I ran, and the Michigan Insurance Coalition. So, that's been basically brought together as one. And I think it's long overdue, at least for the industry representation, because having two organizations out there advocating for the same interests, you know, is not always a good thing. So
you guys are stepping on each other's toes, I'm sure, every now and again.
Yeah, mostly inadvertently. And so that's been resolved. They brought some assets on board. You know, we've got the use of McAlvey and Merchant Associates as a contract lobbyist, and Byram Fisk, the public relations folks, too, to kind of bolster our effort as we move forward. So we're looking forward to it.
Now, how many insurance companies in the state are represented by the Insurance Alliance of Michigan? What, you have like 70% of them?
Well, yeah, as far as when you look at market share, we've probably got 85-90% of the market, depending upon whether you're looking at, you know, homeowners or auto and things of that nature. The personal lines is where most of the focus is, as you know. Work comp has been kind of a dull issue, thankfully, in Michigan since really the mid-1980 reforms, and they've done some other reforms about 6 years ago that helped tighten up. And we represent all interests except health and life. So company-wise, we've got about 36 companies, but when you look at a company, it may have several subsidiaries that you'd recognize. You know, Allstate has Esurance and a couple other subsidiaries that operate in Michigan. AAA owns Fremont Insurance and MIMIC. So when you combine all those up, it's probably closer to 80 or 90 individualized companies. But it's when it comes to market share, you know, we're probably up in the 80 to 90% of the personal lines market anyways.
Well, let's get on the big issue that we're seeing in the Capitol right now, which remains the high insurance rates in the city of Detroit and elsewhere as well. If lawmakers were serious about cutting insurance rates, what's the best way they can go about doing that?
One of the key parts of our no-fault law, which is, as you know, different than any other state in the union, is that we mandate this lifetime unlimited medical benefit. Is that the only component? No. There's other reforms that need to be adopted, too, to help get rates down to where they ought to be. And at the same time, provide the options of folks to be able to purchase this unlimited medical if they want. If we had to pick out one reform, it would really be the adoption of medical fee schedule. I think that's most impactful on the individual premiums across the board.
so that if you get injured in a car wreck, you can only be charged, the insurance company can only be charged X for an X-ray or a CAT scan or whatever.
Right. Exactly like our work comp system. Back in the mid-1980s, they had some major reforms, and they adopted a structure that allows the participants in work comp, the employer, the employees, and the healthcare facilities on an advisory board to set the medical fee schedules and some of the treatment protocols associated with it so overuse isn't done. And that's been really, really successful since the mid-1980s. We'd love to adopt that same fee schedule. I mean, you know, a broken arm is a broken arm, whether it came from an auto accident or a workplace injury.
But is the fee schedule just for Catastrophic Claims Association? That's for any injury?
It's from dollar one, yeah. You know, there's an anomaly, I call it, in the auto insurance laws that basically the standard for no-fault carriers is not what the hospitals receive or accept in payment from other sources, but it's what they charge non-insurance payers. It's really strange statutory section, 3157 of the code. And that's been interpreted to mean that when we come in and say, you know, we shouldn't have to pay more than, you know, work comp, or we shouldn't have to pay more than Aetna, the courts have said no. The statute said, you know, your charges are only limited by what they charge non-insurance payers. And again, it's charges. It's not what they actually receive in payment. So we've got this quandary that the question becomes, what do they charge non-insurance payers? And if you're familiar with healthcare reimbursements at all, you're familiar with what's called the charge master rate. And I call it a retail price on steroids. And nobody except auto carriers pay it. You know, it's kind of a starting point for negotiations under typical insurance contracts. But unfortunately, because of this anomaly in the no-fault statute, we're caught here basically paying whatever charges are put forward for the most part.
So you end up having to pay whatever is the standard price without any deduction, so you can't negotiate with, like, let's say a Blue Cross can do, and they can say, well, we're only going to pay X, or Medicaid say, we're only going to pay Y. You guys have to pay the regular rate.
Pete, these other reforms that you've mentioned about to lower auto insurance rates, would you consider these the low-hanging fruit that the legislature could take out?
You know, in the 12 years I've been doing this, nothing seems to be a low-hanging fruit. It's any kind of reform to the status quo seems to be vociferously, you know, opposed. I'm not sure which components you're talking about, but things like tenant care reforms, yeah, they don't impact the overall premium as significantly as maybe a medical fee schedule does. But really, if we were to get into the arena of what we call PIP choice, that would have a dramatic impact individually depending upon what level of coverage you might purchase.
PIP choice, what do you mean by that?
Well, our personal injury protection is the medical component largely. It's also wage replacement and some other things of the mandate under our law. And that's the big kahuna that basically makes us so different from any other state. In most other states, there isn't actually a medical mandate in the insurance laws. Of the 11 other no-fault states, there is a medical component. That's the whole concept behind no-fault. You go to your own insurer for benefits, and so there's delineated coverage there. But even under no-fault, the coverage mandate varies from about $2,000 to $50,000, and we're unlimited here in Michigan. Two other states actually had unlimited levels initially back in the late 60s, early 70s. I think it was Pennsylvania and New Jersey's. They have since moved away from unlimited mandate and allow the consumers to purchase a level that makes sense for their circumstances. And we think more so than fee schedules, PIP choice, depending again upon the level you choose, could have more impact than even medical fee schedules.
Am I wrong in saying that those most severely impacted by the way we do it in Michigan, where we only have the one choice and you don't have varying, you know, you can get a lower costing premium. The one area of the state that arguably is hit the most because of that would be down by Detroit in the urban areas?
Generally, the cost of that PIP mandate is the same because the MCCA charge is equal regardless of where you live. But the underlying insurance up to the first $545,000 is basically dependent upon where you live and what your driving record is and things of that nature. So yes, PIP is affected by where you live, by the components that you're exposed to, but only partially. So I'm not really quite sure your question. So are the savings equal with regard to the MCCA charge? Absolutely. With regard to the underlying PIP, if we're going to say continue with a $50,000 or a $200,000 PIP mandate, that PIP requirement or that medical coverage would still be affected by the same factors that they are today.
But the classic example that I've always heard is people in Detroit who can't afford insurance driving around without any insurance at all, and that the answer to that was possibly changing the PIP situation so that they can buy affordable insurance at a lower cost but less coverage.
Yeah. And that's the $30,000 question. If we are able to lower premiums, would that affect the uninsured market? Nobody knows for sure, but I think it's incumbent upon us to find out and get there. We have a nicely designed system but it hasn't been updated since 1973. Really, nothing significant has occurred under our no-fault statutes since then. So we've got a system that's suffering from things like lack of any medical protocols in the delivery of health care, lack of a medical fee schedule. If you had choice within the level of coverage, I think you'd have more competition in the marketplace too. You know, we've noticed that we've seen an exodus of auto insurance carriers over the last 15 years here in Michigan. It's about a 2-to-1 ratio from those coming in versus those leaving. It's not some of the major players, mostly because they have huge investments that, it's not an easy decision to make to exit a state. But as far as new players coming in, they're few and far between.
Why?
Well, Michigan is a unique, very difficult environment to make money in as an insurance company in auto. Our markets in work comp and homeowners and others are very successful and very competitive. And we're in the middle of the pack as far as the rates on homeowners insurance, a little bit below the national average. I think our work comp, where we stand on work comp, has always been, since the reforms of the mid-1980s, one of the lower states to do business in. And part of it's the fee schedule that they adopted back in the 1980s. So, we'd like to bring in some of those reforms to the existing system. And we're not talking about dismantling no-fault here in Michigan. We're talking about improving it. Let's put the same cost constraints we see in typical healthcare contracts and things of that nature in place for auto no-fault.
So it seems like what I'm hearing is with fewer competitors in the market that the longer we let this go, the more our insurance rates are going to go up.
Well, you're certainly going to have less competition. Unfortunately, I didn't bring it with me today, but we have data that suggests, as I indicated, under work comp and homeowners and things like this, it's been a very profitable market here in Michigan, no doubt about it. Insurance companies come in here and they make money. Under Michigan no-fault, that's not the case at all. Over the last 10 years that we've had data for, insurers on a net asset basis lost money in 7 of the last 10 years, and that's leading up to 2014. That's the most current data I have. But as a no-fault carrier, and again, this is priced individually. You can't cross-subsidize homeowners and no-fault your auto insurance. So, it's not a very profitable market. Some make money in it, especially our domestics, which have learned to navigate our no-fault system a little bit more effectively than newcomers coming in from out of state. But it's a very, very competitive and difficult market for many.
Should the discussions about reforming car insurance in Detroit and throughout Michigan be separate discussions?
Oh, I don't think so. I think the underlying problems, the inefficiencies of the system we have, the mandate of unlimited, affects everybody equally. I mean, the whole idea behind paying more in an urban area versus outstate is not new to Michigan and unique to Michigan. It doesn't matter where you go, whether it's Chicago or New York or Philadelphia. Unfortunately, urban settings have such certain risk factors that you can't avoid. I call them environmental factors. You live in a very condensed population. You have more vehicles. You're going to have more accidents. That's not your fault, but it's just the environment you live in. It's like living next to the river and you're exposed to a potential flood versus the guy up on the hill. Yeah, the density of the population is pretty significant. The delivery of health care is even more expensive in our urban areas. And that relates back to the uninsured because the hospitals have to take folks in. They can't deny them. They have to get them in and get them stabilized until they can move them out. And so you see a much higher level of uncompensated care in the urban areas, thus the normal charges, if you will, have to be inflated in order to cover their costs.
But is there any other region in the U.S. where the contrast in prices between urban and suburban regions is more stark than it is in Detroit?
Well, I don't know. We'd have to take a look at it. I haven't seen data for that, but it's not surprising to me. We have this really unusual mandate that nobody else comes close to. The next closest state is New York that requires $50,000 in medical coverage compared to our lifetime unlimited. Should it be 100 times more, or be just that component alone? I mean, yes, there are huge discrepancies between urban and suburban rates. But again, it's not so much the issue of where you live as much as the mandate that we have. So if we didn't have this lifetime unlimited mandate, if we had medical fee schedules, if we address fraud, you know, that's one of the things we've supported historically is the establishment of a fraud bureau. We're one of the eight largest states that doesn't maintain a fraud bureau of any sort here in the state to go after insurance fraud. And we think there's a, you know, there could be a significant amount of cost savings just for going after the bad operators.
This is nothing you can do through the insurance code, but what about theft in Detroit? I mean, that's got to be a major player in why the car insurance rates in Detroit are so astronomical.
Well, it's a component of it. You know, and fortunately, the cars are getting better at their security and so forth, so it's harder to steal the newer cars. We have supported, I think, in the better part of 40 years, what's called the Auto Theft Prevention Authority, where about a dollar out of every premium that's sold here in Michigan is sent to this Auto Theft Prevention Authority. And that money is allocated out to local law enforcement and prosecutor's office to combat auto theft. You know, a large portion of that goes to our urban areas. I think the last contract we saw going out to the city of Detroit was approaching $3 million. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've got a very active anti-theft unit. And by all reports, it's been pretty successful in helping cap that down. But it gives the local prosecutors and law enforcement agencies some dedicated funds to go after that particular issue.
Do you feel you're back at square one with all the new people in the house as far as explaining all of this?
On a general education level, yeah. You know, it's difficult to bring everybody up to speed. You know, I talk about our no-fault system. It's not really rocket science, but there's a lot of components to it here in Michigan. So you got to have to be aware of all the various components and how they interact. Actually, I'm pleasantly surprised with a lot of the new folks coming in because auto no-fault seems to be more of a grassroots issue. You know, when we go in and sit down and meet the new legislators, we ask them what were the hot topics on the campaign trail. And increasingly, no-fault's been an issue. I think it's becoming more of an economic issue, both for the personal lines and also on businesses' line. You know, we've seen some of our business representatives down in the city of Detroit area advocating for reform and so forth. So that's going to be interesting. Not that it's this huge grassroots movement, but there's clearly a lot more chatter in the legislature. Clearly, there's a lot more legislators coming to us and asking us what are the solutions to getting us lower rates here in Michigan.
So maybe the atmosphere is more likely for some kind of insurance reform this year as opposed to years prior.
Well, we hope so. You know, we want to be part of the reforms. When we've led the charge in the past, it's been a bloody battle with the opponents, if you will. But I really kind of sense a different attitude coming into this legislature. Now, will it be enough of a critical mass to get, you know, the important things done? I guess time will tell. But I'm really encouraged by the response we've gotten from the new legislators. People coming to us unsolicited and asking us, you know, about proposals and different approaches to reform and so forth. That's clearly up. Of course, the mayor of Detroit has been a great advocate for trying to get something done. And we really like where he's coming from as far as the perspective of, you know, you need to address the major components that drive the costs. And that's our unlimited medical benefit. And giving folks a choice on that doesn't take the unlimited away. If you still want it for your family, it's there for the purchasing. But for the folks that are challenged economically, I think it's a kind of a no-brainer to me. And fortunately, you know, I think I read just recently that 93 or 97% of Michiganders have some form of health insurance, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, you know, military insurance or coverage through work. That's, I think, one of the highest in the nation. We did a good job of expanding the ACA and utilizing that. If you have a limited benefit under your no-fault coverage, like every other state, quite frankly, and you go through that 50 or 100,000 that you have, we have the luxury of a backstop in most cases, of other policies, which in fact do pay, you know, automobile accident benefits in every other state except Michigan, because ours is unlimited and it never runs out. So we never draw on our health care coverage for auto insurance accidents. We never draw on our Medicare, our seniors don't, that they pay for. So, you know, we're kind of duplicating coverages in many respects. Mm-hmm. So we think giving folks the option to, you know, match their coverage with their actual needs and their circumstances makes a lot of sense. You'll have money savings there too, just because of the reduction in the cost of the PIP that you're required to purchase.
Pete Kumanich, he's with the Insurance Alliance of Michigan. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure, Kyle. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Jack and Simon, Mike, and also Pete Kumanich for coming in. We have to figure out what we're going to do with the wall here, guys, in MERS World Headquarters after our television that was affixed to the wall took a very untimely fall over the weekend and met its death on the corner of a chair there. Is there a picture around that we can put over that hole in the wall caused by our now fallen television? Maybe we can move that Kennedy picture over there.
Got all kinds of campaign posters downstairs.
Oh, that's right. We've got some campaign posters. Let's bring some up. We've got that one for Abdul Al-Sayed, that's on your desk there, Simon. We'll bring that and put that right over the top.
Yeah, but then he wouldn't be with his other Democratic candidates on the wall.
Well, what I can say is, you know, borrowing from Donald Trump, we will fix the wall and it will be a big, beautiful wall.
I think we should put out a call for design firms to submit bids to see what kind of, you know, covering we should have for this wall.
And I'm just more for just covering the hole in the wall because I just don't think it looks good. I don't know what we're going to do with that TV either. How do you dispose of the TV with a big frickin' hole in the middle of it? You can't throw that in the garbage thing.
You got to recycle that. That goes the recycling.
Can we put that in our big green bin there that Verge collects every Thursday?
Set the bin on top of it. That's big.
Electronics recycling in America, Kyle, that's a whole other can of worms.
You can watch it anyway. You just have to have a really good imagination.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to end it. Until next week, I'm Kyle Moran. Take care. Thank you.